I was asked to give my testimony real quickly. I was accepted Christ when I was 8 years old in Toledo. Graduated from high school in 1960. My dad was the superintendent for, at the time, was called the largest die-casting plant in Toledo. In May of my senior year, he had to retire because of a disability. So they called me and offered me a job in purchasing, thinking that I wouldn't be able to go to college, and they were pretty right. So I decided to go to night school, University of Toledo, and I, majoring in business, accounting and finance, and took a course in income tax, and I fell in love with income tax. Yeah, I know. Started doing income tax returns for my buddies, and in 1967, my pastor asked me to do his tax return. And I'd never seen a minister's tax return before, and I didn't know how to do it. In fact, I was questioning whether it was done accurately or not. Found out that it had been, and I decided to research. I was captivated by that, so I poured myself into the IRS regulations to try to put the scenario together, and there wasn't a lot of written material out there then. And so I, over time, began to put it together, and the word began to spread around Ohio that this guy from Toledo does tax returns for pastors free of charge. And so, yeah, right, the key was free of charge. So I started to get a lot of requests from pastors and went down to southern Ohio, a school called Cedarville. Many of you have probably heard of that. I taught in the business department for 5 years and worked administration, and the Lord led us out here in 1974, where I became the finance guy for then the Los Angeles Baptist College, now the Master's College and Seminary. In 1975, the word came out to California that I do tax returns for pastors free of charge. Ohio is one thing, California is another. So in 1975, I was invited to the Sylmar Conference Center up near Monterey, San Francisco area, to do a seminar at a pastor's conference, about 400 pastors there, and they gave me 45 minutes, and I decided to do a seminar on the pastor's income tax. These guys had never had anything like that, and so I finished at 10 o'clock that morning, and 45 minutes is not enough time, so I whipped through that thing, and they had allowed a half hour for questions in the program, and those 400 pastors asked me questions for 3.5 hours, and that's when I realized how great the need was. Came back down to my office down here to Newhall, and I was just overwhelmed from calls from these guys that needed help. And a couple months later, a pastor said, come to my church and teach my people what the Bible says about money. So in the fall of 75, I launched the Family Finance Seminar Series, the same year that Larry Burkett launched his ministry out of Atlanta, Georgia. And I knew Larry well. He's with the Lord now, but he became a great friend. And his was, of course, national, the radio and all that, and mine was just the local churches. And did my first couple of family finance seminars, got questions about wills and trusts. So I decided to do those to local churches. And so I poured myself into that arena for a few months and took some seminars and met with attorneys. And then a pastor said, come teach my church leaders about church finance. So I started doing some church finance seminars with the leadership. Did my first one in Moscow, Idaho. Spent 2 days with those deacons and began to realize that some of those guys were not biblically qualified to be leaders in their church. The chairman of the board had just left his wife and was living with another woman, and he was still chairman of that board. I guess I lived a sheltered life up to that point. I was shocked by that. I didn't think that happened in churches. And so I add to my repertoire the qualifications of a godly leader from 1 Timothy 3 and Titus, discovering that I could say things to those leaders that probably a pastor couldn't say. And because I'm getting in my car the next morning and getting out of town, you know. So, 1977, I spoke in a church in Walla Walla, Washington, and a businessman took me to lunch and challenged me to do this full time. And he had some corporations back then, and he said, we will fund you for our corporations, but I want you to move to the Tri-Cities of Washington. So we moved up to the Tri-Cities of Washington, Pasco, Kennewick, Richland, about 200 miles east of Seattle. Kept it there 10 years. That was in 1978. 1981, I went on the board of the college down here. 1984, Dr. Duncan, the president, retired, and we went on a search, and I was vice chairman of the search committee, and the Lord led us to John MacArthur. First time I met him was at the Ranch House Inn out by Magic Mountain. Heard a lot about him, but had never personally met him. And we had a 6-hour interview with John. Well, it was was an inquisition by him of us. He did all the talking, and it was a graduate school, graduate course in theology is what it was. It was incredible. So the Lord led us to him, and we called him to be the president. And for some reason, John and I, our hearts sort of knitted together, and became aware of my ministry. In 87, he asked if I would move my ministry down here, which I did, and we traveled together under the Master's Fellowship. Some of you will remember that. And we traveled for about 4 years and hit all the various cities and did his thing, and I did my thing on pastor and his finances and all that, and sort of launched this thing. And so we've kept it down here since 87. I live out in Newhall. My wife and I spend 4 months a year in the Midwest so we can cover this country with our seminar ministry, and then I spend the rest of the time out here. The hub of our ministry is doing income tax returns for pastors and missionaries. We help about, I would guess, about 8,000 or 9,000. We actually prepare about 2,500 returns a year. We do pastors from all 50 states. The challenge of the states, it's not the federal. It's easy to keep on top of the federal, well, sort of easy. Some of the states is what, the further east you get, the more complex it becomes. Whoever those accountants were, CPAs who put those state rules together for the people in those states ought to be, is this being recorded? At least hung in effigy, okay? Anyway, that's the fun of it. We do pastors from all 50 states, like I said, and that's just a great delight. Well, out of that comes all the requests for the seminars, okay? So John has wanted me to do this every 4 or 5 years at the church, and did the first one back in the early 90s and right in this auditorium. And then did all the fellowship classes. Some of you will remember that. And then John felt it was time to offer it again, so that's what we're all about. So we're here to serve you, folks. We're here to be a help to you in this area of estate planning, the final act of stewardship. And there are some guys here representing the different ministries. As I call out their names, I'd like for them to stand so you can get to know them. You know, your heart may be directing you to one of the ministries with your estate someday in the future, and these guys are here to come alongside you and help you. Master Seminary, Dick Mayhew, where are you at, Dick? Stand up, will you? Everybody knows Richard, but there's Richard. College, it'd be Luke Cherry, Boyd Johnson in the back, and then Steve Dixon is here somewhere. There's Steve. Grace to you, it's going to be Don Carr. Don, where are you? There's Don over here. And I do the counseling for the church and anybody else that wants counseling. But we're here to serve you folks. I want to make sure you know there is no pressure. There is no hidden agenda. Part of the stewardship is that final act of stewardship that we all have a responsibility for. By the grace of God, we are what we are. By the grace of God, we have what we have. And because we live in the great country of America, we're all going to accumulate some kind of an estate. And when we pass away, when God calls us into his presence, my wife and I, a long time ago, determined while we're in eternity, we want to leave part of our estate behind for eternal purposes. It's a great concept, sadly ignored by many believers. But boy, I'll tell you what a great privilege. You know what, folks? We are so, you know, let me say this. I'm all over the country. You people are spoiled rotten. You are part of a great church, great Bible teaching. You're seeing the impact of a wonderful college, a wonderful seminary, grace to you that impacts people all across this globe. What a privilege. And what a privilege to have a part in that. And so we just want to be here to help you, to come alongside you. And so let's have a word of prayer together before we start. Father, thank you for our Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. Thank you for the wonderful privilege we have of being one of your chosen. Thank you for a church like Grace Church and a pastor like John MacArthur who loves you and is faithful to you and is committed to your scriptures. Thank you for the opportunity to get together today, and we just trust this will be stimulating and encouraging. We trust it will help us to be faithful as stewards of Christ. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. You got two handouts when you came in. I want to briefly take you through the one about the finances. Before I do that, let me say this. I want to start out by saying something. This is the greatest capitalistic story ever told, folks. the greatest capitalistic story ever told. We are the greatest country, capitalistic-wise, in the history of the world. And we will continue to be, as long as the Lord wills it. We will continue to be. The world needs our technology. The world needs our service industry. The world needs our agriculture. Drive across the country like my wife and I do. Go through Nebraska, Illinois, Iowa, and see the miles and miles of cornfields. We feed the world. They need us. Yes, we're into a tough recession right now, the toughest in memory, because none of us were alive with the Great Depression. When I went to work in 1960 in the automotive industry, 1961, I was hit with my first recession. Occurred in 1961, lasted 10 months. That was the Kennedy spending policies they blamed it on. 1973 was the second one. That lasted 16 months. That was the oil crisis. Remember 1973, 74? Some of you will remember the gas lines? My wife and I jumped in a U-Haul in Ohio to move out here right in the middle of that. And you could only buy gas if your license plate ended in the number, even number, you buy gas on an even number day. Odd number day. Try coming across the country with that. Well, we did that. 1980, 81 was the third one. That lasted 22 months. That was the Iranian Revolution. You remember that. 1990, that one lasted 8 months. They're not sure what caused that one. 2001, that lasted 8 months. That was the 911 attacks, the accounting scandals. The dot-com bubble busted. We're in the sixth one since I went to work in 1960. This has lasted over 40 months. Average length of recession is 12 months. This one's over 40 months. Unusually long, unusually deep. And we're not out of it yet. Question you should ask, and John addressed this a few weeks ago on a Sunday night. I was back in the Midwest. He sent me the CD to listen to. It was great how he handled that. It's always great how he handles anything. But if you remember, he was referring back to Bible times when they paid about 25% tax. 10%, 10%, 10% every 3 years, and then gleaning, which meant those people, 75% of their income was for discretionary use. Well, today, a lot of people are in about in the same bracket, 25 to 30%. 65 to 70% of your income is discretionary use. We're going to get hit with taxes, folks. We're going to have to pay back this deficit. We've got $2 trillion of funny money running around out there because the printing presses are working overtime every day in Washington, D.C. We're going to get hit with inflation, because the funny money is going to create inflation. You just trust it's not the hyperinflation of the Carter years. The question that God's people need to be asking, I think John addressed this, if I remember correctly, was how do God's people continue to fund his work when we get hit with taxes and inflation? How do we continue to support the wonderful works that come out of this church? Seminary, college, grace to you, all of that. I'll tell you how. Get back to the basics of stewardship. That's how we do it. Back to the basics principles. Take self-gratification out of the vocabulary. That's how we do it. Look in the mirror every once in a while and say, hey, do I need all this stuff? Do I need all these toys? Do I need all these things? So real quickly here, because we got time, I want to take you through that first handout, the finance seminar. Just want to rip you through that. I'm not going to cover much detail here. Just to whet your appetite. Number one, give to the Lord's work. Be generous. Everything starts with a heart of generosity. If my passion is to be generous, everything flows from there because I'm dealing with the right heart. If my passion is to be generous, I'll never let credit cards control my life. Number two, take care of the needs of your family. Pretty basic stuff. Number three, protect your family from a catastrophic occurrence, a disability. Premature disability, premature death. Now you got to throw long-term care in there somewhere. Number four, provide for your future, retirement planning and estate planning. So be generous, take care of the needs of your family, protect your family from a catastrophic occurrence, and plan for the future. Now listen to me, if credit cards control your life, you can't do any of that. You can't do any of that. Can't be generous. Probably not taking care of the needs of your family like you should. You got credit card debt. Can't protect your family from a catastrophic occurrence. Can't afford the premiums. Probably not planning for the future. Probably don't have a retirement plan. Probably not participating in the match with the company where you work if you have a match. Probably don't have a will or a trust. Page 2 is the 14 steps of financial freedom. Again, I want to whip through these. Excuse me. I get bronchial every once in a while. I 1986 and 40 below temperatures in Montana, and I frostbit my vocal cords. So they said every once in a while I start coughing. My wife says it's because I'm getting older. Number one, give God a chance first. I'm not going to go through all these in detail. You are a wonderful lady. I will leave you in my will. You just have to outlive me. Give God a chance first. Take the emotional side of your life. Learn to control the emotional side of your life. It's part of our makeup. It's part of the creation. But we need to learn to control it. My wife and I do this. We go to Valencia Mall. We walk into the store and see something we want to buy. It costs more than $50. We take one more walk around the mall before we make the purchase. You walk away from the store, you've taken the emotion out of it. It's the issue. Learn to be a saver. Learn to spend less than you earn. We're not taught that in this culture. The motto in this culture is, I want what I want. I want it now. I'm even willing to go into debt to get what I want now. That's why we're into this recession. Number four, don't borrow money to have fun. Folks, we live in a 12-month playground. You don't have to look very far to find temptation. Don't borrow money to have fun. We don't do that. My wife and I have never done that in 47 years. When we were engaged for a year and a half, starting in 1961, we put a financial plan together for our marriage. And we've lived that financial plan for 47 years. This is part of that financial plan. You have money in an emergency fund, basic principles. Control your credit cards. $373 million a day goes into the credit card industry as interest income. $373 million a day at Saturdays, Sundays, and holidays? It's a cash cow. I spoke at the Master's Chapel last year, and I used that phrase, and they told me the discussion in the dormitory was, what in the world is a cash cow? 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. Number 7, have adequate life insurance to protect your family. Number 8, be self-insured for life insurance. Some point in time, you shouldn't need life insurance. Homes paid for, pension plans funded, cars are paid for, spouse is protected. Number 9, have a retirement plan in progress by the time you're 40, at least by the time you're 40. Listen to this statistic. People who work for companies that have matching pension plans, 53% do not take advantage of it. I'll get a call during tax season. I get it every year. A pastor will say, call Jim and ask him this question. This is a question. Jim, I work for IBM. If I put 8% of my salary into IBM's 401k, IBM will match that. And then he pauses and he says to me, you think that's a good deal? No, it's a terrible deal. Why would you want to double your money? The guy's elevator doesn't go to the top floor, right? Number 10, own your own home by the time you retire. Basic principle. Number 11, have a workable budget. Stewardship says, I know where my money goes and when it goes there. Number 12, there's a difference between a debt and an obligation. There's no biblical prohibition to borrowing money in Scripture. It's not there. Nothing wrong with borrowing money to buy a home. Beginning of someone's life, they're going to have to borrow money probably to buy a car. Nothing wrong with that. You have an obligation. Pay it back. That's the point. No biblical prohibition. Romans 13, owe no man anything, has nothing to do with borrowing money. Nothing. I get the question in my seminars. I got it a couple weeks ago in a seminar in Ohio. Jim, what do you do with the verse, neither a borrower nor a lender be? And I said, what's the text for that? Oh, I don't remember. I'll say, I know you don't. It's Shakespeare. And he wasn't inspired. Number 13, understand the tax laws applies to you. Sometimes I'm not sure the IRS understands the tax law, but I support the IRS big time. I think they have the toughest job in government. I want to make sure I say that. If you're not happy with your taxes, that's your congressman's issue, not the IRS. They have the tough job of trying to collect it. Number 14, having an estate plan includes a will or trust. We're going to do that in just a second here. Go to the next page. Watch your credit score, folks. Treat your credit score as a valuable asset. That's how lenders determine how much interest to charge you when they loan you money. So you need to control that thing. You make sure you make your payments on time. You don't be late because that affects your credit score. Don't ever charge over one-third of your available credit. Say you have three credit cards. Say you can charge $2,500 on each credit card. Let's say, oh, $2,500 on all three credit cards, total credit available $7,500. You're within the one-third, you're okay, according to their statistics. You go over to one-third, their statistics say you become more of a risk. Your credit score drops, see? That's how that works. Let's say you have three credit cards. You can charge $2,500 on each credit card. Let's say you owe $2,500 on these two credit cards. This one you owe nothing, you cancel this card. What just happened? Your credit score went from one-third to one-half. Your credit score just plummeted. You got to be careful with that. Let's say you have five creditors, three credit card companies, a mortgage, and a car loan, and you're late on this one. All five are notified. This is the age of technology, folks. All five are notified. And a little red flag goes up. You're late in a second payment, another red flag goes up. You're late in a third payment, you go on a report. Credit score goes down. Next page. That's how you project your retirement income, called the 80% rule. What are you taking home now? You want 80% of that when you retire, assuming your home's paid for. This example, this person takes home $50,000 a year, 80%, they want $40,000 when they retire. Over half of that will be funded by Social Security, and Social Security will be here. Don't believe everything the talking hairdos tell you on television. Those people read from a script. It'll be here. You know, there's almost 50 million Social Security recipients in this country. You know what would happen to this country economically if 50 million people stopped getting those checks? This recession would turn into a massive depression, and it would be worldwide. Who's the biggest lender of money to America right now? China. China. We stopped sending out those checks. You know what China would do? They'd call their loans. You know what that would do to this country? We may never recover from it. That will not happen. Social Security will be here. They have to fix it. They don't have a choice. Frankly, it's not that big a fix. It's not that big a fix. That's how you project your retirement income. Next page. Have a budget. Live on a budget. You want to make financial progress? Have a budget. Where does your money go and when does it go there? Look at the next page. That's how you do it. Simple budget worksheet. We're coming into October. October, November, December. Great time to start a budget. Monitor your spending. Run it off to the nearest dollar for the next 3 months. You start the month of October with $200 in a checking account. You bring in $4,000 of new money. You had $4,200 to spend in October. At the end of October, you got $200 left in your checking account. You spend $4,000. Where'd it go? When someone says to you, I don't know where my money goes, you know what they're really admitting? I'm a poor steward. That's what they're really saying. Folks, we're biblicists. We want to live according to the Word of God. We're to be stewards. 1 Corinthians 4:2. You do this for three consecutive months. By the fourth month, you begin to commit it to memory. And it works. And it works. My wife is here. You took her out of this room and asked us some simple questions independent of each other, like how much money's left in a checkbook, we could both tell you. We could both tell you. What paychecks are yet to come in this month? We could both tell you. What bills are yet to be paid this month? I can tell you in specific. She could come pretty close. You know what that means? My wife and I, independent of each other, know our cash flow. We know when we can give more money to the church. We know we can give more money to Grace to You. We can give more money to the college and seminary. We know when we can stay in a little nicer motel. We know when we can do things for the grandkids because we know our cash flow. Cash is king, folks, especially in this economy. But it is all the time. I don't care if it's Grace Church, Master's College, Master's Seminary, Grace to You, your family, cash is king. If I have positive cash flow, I can do what God would have me do. I can do what I want to do, which I trust would be what God would have me do. When you're dealing with negative cash flow, you're swimming upstream all the time. You can't be generous because money controls your life. That's the problem. That's why I wanted to just touch on this a little bit, especially with this economy. Practical tips, have a budget. This is not in your handout. Get out of debt. Control your credit card use. I'm not anti-credit cards. I'm anti-misuse of credit cards. Have an up-to-date will and trust. Now, let me get practical. You can't afford to pay for it now. You can't afford it. Be afraid of credit cards. Respect them. Learn to procrastinate on discretionary purchases. Learn to procrastinate on discretionary purchases. Buy a home, not a castle. And have an emergency fund. If you're talking about being secure for your retirement and you're getting to that age, 50% of your needed income should be guaranteed, like Social Security. Your home should be paid off. You should have a long-term care policy for 5 years. You could cut your monthly expenses by 20% if you had to. That's in retirement. Your death or your spouse's death would not create chaos because you've had some plans for that. The estate plan is one of them. So take your handout. Let's go through the estate plan. Probably the most neglected area among adults is this area right here. Stewardship is not just money, time, or talent. Stewardship is all of these and more. Stewardship is the very life God has given us, and someday we shall be responsible to give an account of it all to Him. That's David Jeremiah's book on finance. Two precious freedoms, the right to accumulate an estate, the right to give it away before and after you die. Not many people on this planet have the privilege to do that. $250 million per week goes into probate court undesignated. Millions of dollars per year goes into federal and state treasuries because people die without wills and without any heirs. 30% of adults have a will written correctly. It means 70% of adults do not. Most of the 70% don't even have a will. Less than 10% have done any serious estate planning. You'll understand that more by the time we're done with this. 11 of 12 women will become widows and will be widows for an average of 11 and a half years. That's a pretty startling statistic right there. Why spend 40 years acquiring an estate, 10 years trying to conserve it, but not 2 hours on what you're going to do with it when God calls you into His presence? Shake off any notion you need to be rich before you need an estate plan. If you're like most Christians, tax considerations take a far back seat to the top priority of estate planning, taking care of your heirs and the Lord's work. What's at stake is perhaps best seen by conjuring up the mess you can leave behind if you procrastinate all the way to the grave and die without a will. Your state's rules of intestacy will write a one-size-fits-all estate plan for you. That simply means that if you don't have a will, the state of California has prepared one for you. That's what that means. Dying intestate means that the state steps in. You do not want your estate to pass according to the laws of California, folks. You don't want to go there. Contrast that to the almost unlimited flexibility that's yours if you write a comprehensive estate plan, including a will and living trust. You have the right to name the guardian of your choice. You can slice the pie however you choose. You want grandmother's hutch to go to a favorite niece. Your home to your church, no problem if you have an estate plan. Page 2. Basic terminology. Testator or testatrix, a person who makes a will. Testator is a male, testatrix is a female. Surprised they're not using test a person today, huh? A will is a writing that provides for the distribution of property upon the death of the writer, but which confers no rights. Prior to that time, I recommend you use an attorney. Attorneys are professionals. Attorneys understand the laws of the state of California. Attorneys understand the federal laws. We can help you get to the right attorney. That's why we're here. Codicil is how you amend a will. You have a will prepared, you want to make a change, you don't cross something out, and right above it, you could void the whole document. You write a legal amendment called a codicil, which has to be witnessed. You are one of the few states here that's a community property state. There are 9 of them in the United States. You've seen some of them listed there. California is one of them. It's property acquired during a valid marriage while domiciled in a community property state, with the exception of property acquired by gift. Now, what in the world does that mean? My wife and I are residents of the state of California. Whatever we accumulate during our lifetime belong equally to each other. Passing my estate or our estate from spouse to spouse in California is simple, because of community property laws. So passing an estate from spouse to spouse here is not complex. It's the second death is where it gets complex. So whatever my wife and I have accumulated belongs equal to each other. Now, let's say she's got a father. And let's say he dies. He's a widower. And he dies and he leaves my wife $50,000. And my wife puts it in her checking account. Her checking account. That means it's separate property. It's not community property. She dies, it has to pass by her will or trust. If she decides to take that $50,000 and put it into our joint checking account, it becomes community property. Let's say her dad passes away and leaves a home to her. Her name is on the deed. That is separate property. She puts my name on the deed with her name, it becomes community property. That's huge when it comes to passing the estate, see? Probate is the act by which a proper court accepts a will and declares that this instrument satisfies the statutory requirements as the will of the person who wrote it, the testator or testatrix. Till a will is probated, it has no legal effect. Probate costs vary from state to state. In this state, approximately 5 to 8% of the estate goes for probate costs, court costs, attorney's fees, appraisal fees, publication fees, all of that. Not cheap in this state. 3 people. Executor, personal representative, is a person who administers your estate when you die. My wife, now we're talking about wills now. We're not the trust yet. We'll get the trust a little bit later. When my wife and I had a will, she was my personal representative. I die, she takes care of the affairs of the estate. She dies, I take care of the affairs of the estate. My wife and I would have passed away in a common accident. My son, our son, was the successor personal administrator. He would have taken care of the affairs of the estate. You will have to name somebody if you have a will prepared. That's an important issue. That's an important appointment, because that person has decision-making powers. So your personal representative or executor or executrix would be someone you know, someone you trust, preferably somebody in the family. Guardians take care of minor children. If you're here this morning and you have minor children and you don't have a will, shame on you for this issue right here. It's an important issue. You have a say-so in who would take care of your children if you and your husband or you and your spouse suddenly were taken home in an accident. You have a part in that decision. Judge makes final decision, so you nominate, you don't appoint. A judge has to be the one who appoints it. Recently, there was a court case in Connecticut. 2 couples lived across the street from each other. One of the couples was the pastor of the church and his wife, church just like this church, Bible-believing church, godly people. Across the street were members of his church, a husband and a wife. They had a 3-year-old little girl. The couple had prepared their will and decided that they wanted the pastor's wife to be the guardian of the 3-year-old if something was to happen to them. They were killed in a car accident. Pastor and his wife assumed that they would get the little 3-year-old girl. Lady on the block wrote a letter to social services claiming that the pastor and his wife were religious fanatics. Social services came in, took the 3-year-old girl, put her in a foster home. Pastor and his wife contested that in court and lost. Took it to appellate court and lost. Took it to the Connecticut Supreme Court and lost. Cost them over $100,000 of their money, their own money, to try to get custody of this little 3-year-old girl. The article was featured in World Magazine. The document's front cover was about that thick that they had to provide to the court system. They were encouraged to take it to the U.S. Supreme Court. They refused to do that because, number one, you got to get on the docket. And number two, it takes years to get your case listened to at the U.S. Supreme Court. They were concerned that even if they did win the case, by that time the three-year-old could be a teenager. Even if they won the case, it's doubtful that the U.S. Supreme Court would have taken that little three-year-old out of that foster home. So this couple wrote an article. In that article, this was their four recommendations because of that experience. When it comes to guardianship, favor relatives over third parties wherever possible. Obviously, the number one criteria is a godly home. If you have minor children and you don't have someone in your family that has a godly home, then you're going to have to step out of the family. The church like this, it wouldn't be hard to find someone that would be qualified. Over the years, my wife and I, because of our ministry, we were named in, I don't know how many wills, as guardians. We just hoped they didn't go on a cruise in the North Atlantic and all of them hit an iceberg. Develop a relationship between the child and the person you've named. When the kids are old enough, if the kids are old enough and something happens to mom and dad, a judge will ask the kids, how would you feel about going to Uncle Don and Aunt Peg? He'll want to know that because he has final decision, see? He has the final issue to deal with. Number three, name at least three potential guardians in your will. Primary number one, alternate number one, alternate number two. Why? It'd be difficult for a judge to turn down all three. See, that judge turned down that pastor and his wife because of that letter, see? Number four, you can write a testimony on your will why you selected the guardian you selected. Spiritual reasons, financial reasons, family reasons, all those reasons. What you're doing is you're giving a judge, an independent judge who doesn't know you from A to Z, you're giving him all the information you can give him to make the decision you would have wanted him to make if you were still here. Trustees take care of money for another person's benefit. Sometimes it can be for a handicapped child for the rest of that handicapped child's life. That would be a trustee of a trust. Minors don't inherit money. When my wife and I had a will and our kids were minors, we had the will incorporated so that, and then we had incorporated into the document a process that neither one of our kids would inherit any money from the trust until the youngest one hit the age of 24. Why did we do that? We wanted our kids to go to Christian college. So we wanted the trust fund to support their Christian college, through them through Christian college. When the youngest one would have hit 24, which would have been Jim, what would have been left in the trust and would have been divided three ways, a third to Jim, a third to Pam, a third to the Lord's work. That's the kind of decisions you have to make when you talk about estate planning, folks. What happens if your whole family gets wiped out? And there's a home, and there's maybe a pension plan, and maybe there's life insurance. Where does it go? You got to think about that. You got to pray about that. Those are issues you're going to have to address, see? That's why you need some counsel. That's why we're trying to make people available to you that can help you think through what the Lord would have you do. Tenancy in common, tenancy by entirety, joint tenancy with right of survivorship is how you pass ownership. In this state, typically you see the third one, joint tenancy with rights of survivorship. If you went to your bank tomorrow, had them pull out your signature cards, you would see you and your spouse's name with the initials JTRS. That means joint tenancy with right of survivorship. That means that if one of you passes away, the other, the survivor, has immediate access and immediate ownership. Why they do that? Check the deeds to your property. It would have you and your spouse's name on it with JTRS. One dies, survivor has immediate ownership and access. State tax is the everything tax. It's an excise tax levied on the transfer of a person's property by the federal government in excess of the unified credit. Now, what in the world does that mean? Well, in this year, 2010, it's very interesting. There is no tax on estates in 2010 as of right now because Congress cannot come to an agreement. They spent their time on health care. When you heard Bush talking about permatizing the Bush tax law changes, You're hearing about a lot of that right now, the income tax issues, which is a huge issue. That wasn't his primary concern before he left office. His primary concern was this one. Because through 2009, the first $3.5 million of somebody's estate went to the heirs tax-free, unless it was a pension plan. Because they couldn't come to an agreement, 2010, there is no tax on any estate. When Steinbrenner, the owner of the Yankees, died this year, he has a $1 billion estate. In 2009, 500 a million of that would have gone to the government. 2010, none of it's going to the government. It all went to the kids. That's why the joke was, if you're going to die in 2010 if you're worth a lot of money. They will address that, probably, because they should address it. They're probably going to settle on $3.5 million. That's probably what they're going to do. You'll see it in the news. But that's what that's addressing. So right now, there is no excise tax on the transfer of a person's property. You just have to pay income tax on pension plans. There is no inheritance tax in California. That went out in 1982. That may come back, because California is broke. It's broke. We'll see. Page 3. What happens when you make your will? You exercise your right to decide how your property will be distributed. You provide for your heirs in a way that you choose. You make sure that others won't distribute your property according to their whims or uninformed opinions. Number 4, you keep your property from going to undeserving people. You can disinherit if you want. I had a fellow in a seminar I did this last summer say to me, I'm going to disinherit my unregenerate son. He's walked away from the Lord. His name was Bill. I said, Bill, what happens if your son accepts Christ at your funeral? He didn't know how to deal with that one. Number 5, you use a channel, written will, to remit charitable bequests. Don't forget the Lord's work, folks. Like we said earlier, by the grace of God, we have what we have. Number 6, you provide guardians for your children if they're minors. Number 7, you avoid misunderstanding among your heirs. I know biological brothers and sisters that don't speak today because of the way mom and dad's antiques and heirlooms were divided up after they died. I witnessed a fist fight in a funeral home. Two brothers got in a fist fight over their dad's gun collection. He's laying there in a casket. We had to take him outside, break it up. Oh, that doesn't happen. My kids would never fight. Oh, really? Really? You have the perfect kids, right? Not in this life, you don't. Number 8, you have the final word in fulfilling your goals as a good provider, a good citizen, and a good steward of your property. What if you don't have a will? You die intestate. We talked about that. The state steps in. If you have a will now, check to see if there's been a change in your marital status. You know, second marriage has become complex because you got two families now. That takes some counseling to work through that. Has there been a change in your health status? Maybe you've been diagnosed with a terminal disease. You better make sure your estate planning is up to snuff. Have you moved to another state since making your will? State laws are different. If you had a will drafted in Oregon, it's going to be different than California. Oregon's not community property. California is. Probably should have it reviewed by somebody. Are your beneficiaries still living? Are they still worthy? Did a seminar in Idaho. A widower had two apartment houses. He had two sons. He had it set up so one son gets the one apartment house, the other son gets the other. He sold the one apartment house, forgot to amend his estate planning. So if he dies, the one son is sort of cheated a bit. And when we did the seminar, a light went on. The guy amended his estate planning. Number 7, is your family secure to permit you to switch some requests from them to charitable organizations? My son-in-law is a physician. My son's a CPA. We've told both our kids, as you get on financially, we're probably going to leave less to you and more to the Lord's work. They won't come to my seminars anymore. They think they're getting their legs cut off. Number 8, you may then need to review your will or trust with your attorney. What to do in the case of the death of your spouse? This is an important page, folks, number 4. If you walk out of here with nothing, walk out with this. A number of years ago, I did a seminar in Montana, Kalispell, Montana. And the month before I got there, two women became widowers, widows. And they needed some help. So they asked me to stay over another day and work with these widows. And they didn't know up from down what came to their estate. I get back home, Richland, Washington, and I sit down at the dining room table, and I said, honey, we need to put together some instructions here for you in case something happens to me. This was that list that we did. We put all the documents together, all the documents that pertain to our marriage, the deed to the home, the titles to the cars, the life insurance policies, pension plans, put them in a pile, marriage license, put them in a pile, put a rubber band around that pile. Then we answered all these questions on a piece of 8.5 by 14 yellow pad paper, wrapped those answers around those documents and put them in our safe deposit box. If I keel over with a heart attack, my wife goes to the safe deposit box, gets all those documents, takes them home, puts them on the dining room table. She knows exactly what to do and where everything is at, after she's grieved, of course. If my wife and I get killed in a common accident, my son is the successor trustee to our trust. He's on the signature card of the safe deposit box. He goes to the safe deposit box, gets the documents. He knows where everything is at. He knows exactly what he has to do. Pretty slick, folks. Pretty slick. Number one, don't make hasty decisions. Seek counsel. Immediate contacts. Be good to write those down. Mutually agree on one person who can be objective in counseling on financial matters, someone you both trust. It took my wife a few days to work through that. I'm gone now. Who does she counsel with? Identify the procedure whereby the spouse can gain access to some immediate cash. She's going to need some money to hold her over until life insurance proceeds come in or pension plans become available or whatever. Number five, list by company, agent, amount, beneficiary, and location of policies of all life insurance that's in force. Who's the agent? How much life insurance is there? You know, most people I counsel with can't even tell me how much life insurance they have, let alone who the agent is. Stewardship says, I'm providing for my family if God calls me into his presence prematurely. I have a stewardship responsibility to do that. It's not showing a lack of faith. That's showing stewardship. Most people are underinsured. And today the products are cheap because the life insurance industry has gone through a tremendous overhaul because people are living longer and premiums have dropped. Good time to buy life insurance. Number six, list all checking and savings accounts, CDs, IRAs, all other investments that are easily converted to cash. Identify the institution, a branch location. Check to see if the accounts are held jointly or if they are in the trust. With right of survivorship, so spouse has easy access. See? Talking about wills now, remember. Number seven, contact the local Social Security office or VA office for benefits or changes in benefits. You know, I find a lot of misunderstanding in Social Security. There's a lot of ladies who feel they'll get Social Security the rest of their life if their husband passes away. That's not true. That's not true. If you have minor children at home and your husband passes away, you get Social Security for each one of those kids until they reach 18 or graduate from high school, whichever comes later. And then you'll get Social Security until the youngest one hits the age of 16. When your youngest child hits 16, mom loses her Social Security. As each kid hits 18 or graduates from high school, whatever's later, they lose their Social Security. Mom gets no more Social Security until she's 60. A lot of ladies don't understand those rules. Now, I get a call during tax season. It's amazing. A pastor will call me. He'll say, Jim, I'm going to retire. No, I'm turning 62. I'm going to take my Social Security early. I said, really? You're 62. You're going to take your Social Security early. You're still pastoring? Oh, yeah. How long are you going to pastor? Till the Lord takes me home or till I lose my health? So you're going to pastor probably at least till 70. Yes. And you were counseled to take your Social Security at 62. Yes. I said, who counseled you to do that? So he'll tell me, and I'll say, he doesn't know up from down. You take your Social Security at 62, You can make $13,000 a year. For every dollar, every $2 you go over $13,000, you're going to give a dollar back Social Security, and you've locked into that number. Who gave you that counsel? The counsel out there is horrible. You don't automatically take early Social Security without counsel, folks. Number eight, contact the attorney who prepared the will. Make sure the spouse knows who the executor is. Usually it's her, but not always. You'll get multiple copies of the death certificate from the funeral director because you have to apply for claims and to move his IRAs into your IRA. If it's your husband that passes away, that takes a death certificate to prove the death or get the proceeds from the life insurance policies. Number 10, contact your employer union for possible benefits. Sometimes there's death benefits if a spouse is still working. Number 11, list other investments and assets. If it's a credit card, it's a credit card and asset. Can be to a surviving widow for a while. Real estate, stocks and bonds, titles to the cars, deeds, marriage license, wills, trust agreement, community property agreement. You don't have that in this state. That's state of Washington. Divorce decrees. You've had a divorce. Where's the divorce decree? I counseled with a lady out in Santa Clarita. Second marriage. Second marriage took place like 15 years ago. Had six kids by the second marriage. He dies of a heart attack. She goes to Social Security office to get benefits. Social Security office turns on the string, puts in a Social Security number, has his whole history, and says, where's his divorce decree? She'd never seen it. They said, because you can't produce his divorce decree, we're going to take the position he wasn't legally divorced, therefore you're not legally married, therefore there's no Social Security benefits for you and the kids. Well, that person couldn't do that. That violated the law. But what's she going to do? So she calls my office, we get an attorney, took about 3 months, got her Social Security benefits. Shouldn't have happened. She'd had a divorce decree, it would have been slick as a whistle, see, there'd have been no issue. This is a very litigious, complex society. And you just got to make sure we do things decently and in order. Number 12, carefully consider and discuss options and alternatives offered by a local funeral director. Time to plan a funeral is when both are alive. I'll tell this one. I got to tell this one. I didn't tell it the first hour. I did a seminar, pretty good-sized seminar, and a lady sitting in the front row, she said, I want to know what you think about cremation. I never got that question before. I said, I don't really know. I've never addressed that. Well, I need to know what you think about it. I said, I don't have an opinion. And I don't, and at that point, I wasn't sure what Scripture says, so now I find it doesn't say anything about it. I said, I don't have an, no, she says, it's important that I know what you think about cremation. She wasn't going to let it go. Her husband's sitting right next to her. And I said, well, ma'am, I said, this is open mouth, insert foot, okay? I said, well, ma'am, well, during your marriage, have there been times when he's really burnt you up at times? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, here's your chance to get even. Wrong. Wrong. She laughed. He didn't. Number 13, don't loan money to relatives without independent counsel. I could write a book on this one. Widows who've been taken advantage of because of charlatans, and a lot of them occur in the family. Oh, mom, oh, auntie, if I had $25,000 for my business, I'd be on my way, and she's grieving, she just lost her mate. Hard to say no, especially to a loved one. So she's vulnerable. So widows need someone they can turn to get counsel from that's neutral, independent, no conflict of interest. It's a great ministry in a church, great ministry. Number 14, don't listen to any advice on investments and don't make investments of any sort until your mind is working more normally and you've had ample time to get the advice of competent, objective advisors concerned only with your welfare. Don't buy or sell securities. Don't make loans. Don't buy annuities. Don't insure. Do anything. Your money supply is limited. Take your time and get the best advice possible. I'm just saying get good counsel. I'm not saying don't do any of these things. Get good counsel before you do any of them. Too often, a lot of time and money could be spared. A departed spouse could return for 20 minutes and answer a few simple questions. You should have an inventory of what you own. Page 5. Now we're getting to the trusts. you just received a card like this. It's a questionnaire. This is for your assistance. This is for your help, folks. We're here to help you. I would encourage you to fill this out. Put your name, address, phone number, email address. I will call you if you want counsel. You put your name on here, you're telling me you would like to meet with somebody and have some counsel. If you check one of those boxes, at the bottom, if you check like the Master Seminary, you're going to hear probably from Bob White. If you're from Grace 2, you'll probably hear from Flowers or Don Carr. Hear from Grace. If you check Master's College, you'll hear from one of the three guys, Luke Cherry or Boyd or Steve Dixon. If you check Grace Community Church, or don't check any of them, you'll get me, and I'll be glad to counsel with you. I've blocked out the next 3 months to counsel with people. We're here to assist you. Please don't walk out of here thinking we are trying to twist anybody's arm or use any influence. That's not our purpose at all. John's heart was to make this ministry available to you, to come alongside you, to help you with that final act of stewardship. That's what this is all about. So you follow the dictates of your heart. Whoever you want to leave your estate to, if just all to your heirs, that's between you and the Lord. You decide to leave one of the ministries, that's between you and the Lord. But you're probably going to want some counsel, and we're here, and it's free, folks. You can't beat the price tag. And if you don't check any of those boxes, or you check Grace to you, or you check the Grace Community Church, you'll get me. Or you check other, you'll get me. So I just want to make sure I say that. Now, let's get to the trust. Okay. Fill this out and hand it to the guys at the door as you leave, and there'll be a follow. You'll hear from somebody within 45 days. Depends on how many we get. All right, let's talk about the family trust. My wife and I were concerned a while back about the cost of probate in California and the delay of probate. It takes 9 months to 2 years to probate a will in California. While a will is being probated, it's under the control of the probate court. So I didn't want my estate under the control of the probate court. And I didn't want to pay the 5% to 8% for probate fees and all the related fees. And so I said to my wife, we need to put together the revocable family trust. So we did, about 20 years ago. Revocable family trust is one of the most popular vehicles in this country, honored by all 50 states. Revocable family trust has a life of its own. It's an entity of its own. It's almost like a corporation, although it's not a corporation. Because it's our trust, my wife and I are co-trustees of the trust. Jim and Joan Rickard. Because our last name is Rickard, our trust is called the Rickard Family Trust. We had an attorney draft the documents for us, and then we funded the trust with our deeded entitled assets. My wife and I don't own our condominium in Newhall anymore. We quit claim deed the title into the name of the Rickard Family Trust. Doesn't in any way impact Proposition 13. Nothing changes except the ownership. Rickard Family Trust owns the home. We are the trustees. We control all that. Put your checking account into the trust. Checking account, your checks say Rickard Family Trust. Well, yours wouldn't say Rickard Family Trust. You can if you want. It'd say your name Family Trust, and you sign you and your spouse as trustees. When we sign checks, we would sign checks just like you do. We're just signing as trustees of the trust. Savings account would be in the name of the trust. If you have any stock, you'd give a copy of your trust agreement to your stockbroker. When he buys stock, he buys into the name of your trust. The beneficiary of my life insurance is not my wife. It's the Rickard Family Trust. Why is that? If I die, she's the beneficiary, and she inherits the life insurance. Let's say it's $500,000. $500,000 is in her checking account. Then she dies, you got a probate problem. That $500,000 has to be probated to get to the heirs or to get into the trust. The beneficiary now is the Rickard Family Trust of my life insurance. I die, the life insurance goes into the Rickard Family Trust. She is successor trustee, survivor trustee. She can write checks on that money. She can do anything she wants to, take a cruise, whatever she wants to do, she can do with that money. It's under her control. Then she dies, it passes through the trust. There's no probate, you see? Let me say it to you this way. When you pass the ownership of your assets by will, California will or your will that you had drafted, You pass that ownership under probate law. When you pass the ownership of your assets by trust, you're passing that ownership under contract law. My wife and I have written a legal binding contract honored by all 50 states. It's huge, which takes probate out of our life. There's no probate. There's no probate. Now, a trust doesn't protect your estate from creditors because it's revocable. Only irrevocable trusts protect your estate from creditors if the irrevocable trust was established prior to the problems with the creditors. Otherwise, they can pierce it. So a family trust is revocable, doesn't protect you from creditors. All it does is protect you from the probate process. That's what it does. That's huge. Look at the advantage of a revocable living trust. Letter A, it bypasses probate. You just took probate out of your life. Letter B, there will be minimal or no attorney fees at death. The attorney fees are when the attorney drafted the trust for you, wrote the contract. Letter C, distribution can take place immediately. My wife and I was to pass away, common accident. My son gets the documents from a safe deposit box. He can begin distributing cash to his sister, himself, and the Lord's work. The next day, there's no 9-month delay. He just has to make sure all the bills are paid because he's the trustee, see? Letter D, you can revoke it or change it at any time. As long as my wife or I are alive, we can change the trust any way we want because it's revocable. The minute my wife and I die, the second death occurs, the trust becomes irrevocable. My son, as successor trustee, cannot change the trust. All he can do is carry out what we told him to do in the trust, in the contract. Letter E is confidential. One of you passed away this week. If you have a will, we could go down to the county courthouse in about 3 weeks and get a copy of your will if you have one. Not so a trust. A trust is confidential to the heirs and the trustees. That's huge. Letter F, very difficult to contest a trust. A lot easier to contest a will. You know, you can file a lawsuit against anybody for anything. Whether it gets to court or not is the question. You can contest any will or any trust. The question is, how successful will you be? People contest wills because they feel they were cheated. My mom and dad were coerced. My mom and dad were not of sound mind. My mom and dad forgot me. And I want my pound of flesh. I want my part. But mom and dad didn't want them to have their part. So they contest it. And sometimes they win. Living trust, very difficult to contest successfully. My wife and I, we did our trust 20 years ago. We quit claim deeded our assets into the trust 20 years ago. We put our checking account in the trust 20 years ago. How are they going to contest that? Mom and dad were not of sound mind? They might say that about me, but they won't get away with her. Mom and dad were coerced by who? By who? 20 years ago? No, I don't think so. Very difficult to contest a trust successfully. Disadvantages of revocable living trust. All property wish to be distributed to the trust must be put into the trust. You have to fund it. I'll do a will seminar in a church Sunday night. And sometimes I'll stay in the home of a member of the church, and they'll be sitting there in their living room, and they'll bring their trust out to me and say, we've had this prepared. Would you look it over? I'll look it over. And next question, I'll say, you know, this is a nice document. It looks great. Who owns your home? Oh, we do. The deed to the house. Whose name is it in? Well, it's in my wife and I's. You haven't funded the trust. The home should be deeded into the name of the trust. Now, if you die, how do you get the home into the trust? Probate. How do you get the home to the heirs? Probate. You have not accomplished what you set out to accomplish. Not good. Letter B, the trust must be maintained over your lifetime. You got to remember, if you sell your home, you sell it out of the trust. We owned a home in Goshen, Indiana. We sold it in 1999, I believe it was. It was in the trust. All I had to do was go down to the title company, show them a copy of the trust document that proved my wife and I were trust. We signed as trustees. That was it. We walked out of there with our check in our hand and the closing in the escrow. Simple. It was simple. The receipt's more expensive to create. Trusts are more expensive than wills because it's a contract. Wills down here, my wife and I wanted to get a will today, one for her, one for me, it would be probably $300, $350 for both, not each. Living trusts will cost anywhere from $600 to $3,000, depending on how complex you are. Typically, it's $600 to $1,500. When I meet with you, and you need a trust, I'm going to ask you some questions about your estate. And then I'll refer you to the estate, the attorney that I think would be the most helpful to you. Typically, it's going to cost you $600, $750, $1,200, $1,500 at the most. It's the attorneys we have available to us. And they know the Lord. They know the Lord. I don't know if you remember, about 3 years ago, we hired a development officer at the college. Some of you may know that. And a gifted guy. Boy, I'll tell you, finding these guys is awful hard. Took 2 years for Dick Mayhew to find this guy and interviewed the guy for 2 years. He's with us a year and he dies of a heart attack. I mean, you remember that? Died of a coronary? Sad loss, I'll tell you. They're hard to find. So we've done some research to make sure we find attorneys that love Christ that would help you do what you want to do. And that's what we're here for, folks, just to be of help to you. Next page. Oh, let me mention one of the charitable remainder unit trust. Let me mention this. Let's say you had $100,000 you wanted to give to this church eventually. You don't think you're going to need the $100,000, but you're going to need the income off of it. You could set up a charitable remainder unit trust. What you do, you'd put that $100,000 in a charitable trust. Because you do that, you get a tax deduction for part of it, depending on your age. It comes off your tax return. If you can't use the whole deduction the first year, you can carry it forward for 5 years. You get the income off that $100,000 for the rest of your life. Then when you die and your spouse dies, what's left in that trust goes to the charities of your choice. And you can change those charities before you die. It could be Grace Church. It could be any charity. It's a wonderful vehicle. Wonderful vehicle. Next page, powers of attorney. The third one and fourth one, health care and durable. Some states call it health care power of attorney, California Advanced Health Care Directive. My dad died in a hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1986. The year before he died, he told me, he said, I'm having some problems. I don't think I'm going to live much longer, which we all knew that. He said, Jim, I want to give you my health care power of attorney. I don't want to be on life support. Has a heart attack. I fly into the Detroit, drive over to Ann Arbor, meet with two cardiologists, and he's gone. They say he's gone. There's no brain waves whatsoever. They said, well, you should take him off of life support. They can't do it on their own. They have to have our permission. So I meet my mother, my brother, my sister, and I said, you know what? He's gone. So we made a decision to unplug him. We had to be in the room when they unplugged him. I could do that because I had his health care power of attorney. Now it's changed. Some hospitals require the family to do the unplugging because of lawsuits. So it's getting a little more complex. A few years later, my mother was diagnosed with dementia, living in Cedarville. My brother calls me and says, Mom's been diagnosed with dementia. We had a lot of fun with that, my brother and I, by the way. My brother would send her flowers every holiday. Very faithful. Sometimes I'd be traveling, I'd forget. So I'd call Mom, Mom, did you get my flowers? Those were years. Yeah. I said, I'll bet that tightwad Don didn't send you any flowers, did he? No, I told her the truth eventually. So she didn't remember. So my brother called me and said, go down and get Don's durable power of attorney, or Mom's durable power of attorney, DPOA. So he did. When she signed that DPOA, it allowed my brother to transact business for my mother until she died. Durable power of attorney means durable through incapacitation. A power of attorney ceases at incapacitation. So Don went down and got her durable power of attorney. Next thing is the HIPAA authorization. It's not in your handout. It's called a health insurance Portability and Accountability Act. It allows the release of medical information. You realize that if I'm traveling, and let's say I'm in Philadelphia, and I have a health issue, and I go into the hospital, do you know my wife cannot get information on my health from that hospital without a HIPAA authorization now? Do you know that? That's new. That's new. So the attorney will help you with that now. So I'm in the process of having HIPAA authorizations prepared on me, and then my wife, give them to my kids, my wife, me. Something happens, that HIPAA authorization allows people to have access to my health information. So folks, your attorney, when he does the trust, he'll also do a pour-over will for you, P-O-U-R. Pour-over will is a protection mechanism. Guardians have to be handled by a judge, the final decision, so that's done through a pour-over will. You can't do guardianship through a trust. You've got to do it through a pour-over will, P-O-U-R. Remember, the trust takes you out of probate, so then there's no judge involved in a trust. So guardianship, a trust, a judge has to be involved. So you got to do guardianship through a pour-over will when you have a trust. So folks, you're talking about wills, you're talking about family trust, you're talking about pour-over wills, you're talking about durable power of health, durable power of attorney, HIPAA authorizations. I have faced all of them except the HIPAA authorization. You will too. Not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. So we're making this available to you. This was a burden on John's heart just to come alongside you in this way to be of assistance any way we can. I'm here for you. This is what I do. So, you know, feel free to use the service. Can't beat the price. And it's just my office. I'm on the edge of the campus at the college. They gave me some space there for my ministry, and that's where we operate out of. So take advantage of it. It's for you. Anybody have a quick question that maybe apply to everybody instead of if you had an individual question, you should meet with one of the guys. Yes. No, that depends. You can have life insurance trust, sure. If you're worth a lot of money, very wealthy families have a lot of different trusts they can go through. But a simple person doesn't need a life insurance trust. You just need a life insurance and make your revocable family trust the beneficiary of your life insurance. Yeah. Life insurance trusts only get in play when you've got very prosperous people involved. Yes, sir. What's that now? Yeah, homeowner's insurance doesn't change if it's in the name of the trust. Shouldn't. Pardon? Who is the name of the insured? Your family trust. Yeah, because the trust owns it. You're kidding me. Go to another insurance company. I don't understand that. Yeah, I don't understand that. So you're telling me they won't insure your house if it's in a family trust? Well, that's okay. Well, if it's made out to you as an individual, it would end up in the trust. Yeah. Yeah, we get there by through the pour-over will or by the trust agreement. No. No, you just put it in the trust. The survivor would, or your heirs would, or your successor trustee would. Yeah. Yes. I can't hear you. Well, if you have four different siblings, how does a family trust work? Well, the family trust is like a will. The family trust would give instructions who gets what upon the second death. It would be under the initially it would be, yes. Yeah, sure. We got to be real quick here, okay? Pardon? Yeah, you can't leave money to a minor. You'd have to leave it in trust for the minor. Minors don't inherit money. It'd be within the trust and managed within the trust until he becomes an adult, he or she. Yep. Minors don't inherit money. Yep. Do I recommend whole life or term life? Buy the product that protects your family that fits your budget. Probably going to be term. You know, you don't buy life insurance for investment purposes. You buy life insurance to protect your family from a catastrophic occurrence. I bought my first life insurance policy. I was 24, bought a 10-level policy to 34 because that's all I could afford at 24. All right? When did I renew it? When I was 29. I found out the biggest increase in premiums occurred in a decade of my birthday. So at 29, I'm making a little more money. I renewed my term insurance to 49. I got a 20-year level term. Then I renewed it at 44 to 64. Then I renewed it at 54 to 74. I staggered it. That's how I did that. 74, I have no more life insurance because I don't need it. My spouse is protected if something happens to me. People say, why do you have life insurance now? If something happens to me, I want to make that second guy really comfortable. If you believe that, I got swampland in Florida. Yes. Life insurance is not taxable. No. No. No, you just have beneficiary. Pension plans are taxable. Deferred pension plans, you're deferred the tax, which means a beneficiary of a pension plan is going to pay tax on that pension plan unless it goes to the Lord's work. Let's say you're worth $500,000, everything together, and you want to give $100,000, let's say, to Grace Church, and you got $100,000 in a pension plan. Leave the $400 that's on the pension plan to the kids. Leave the $100,000 pension plan, make the beneficiary of the church. You just save tax on the $100,000. If the kids get the $100,000, they're going to have to pay tax on that from the pension plan. That's why counsel is important, you see. There's some things you can do to avoid all that. We got about 1 minute back here. Yeah. I would say review your estate planning documents every 2 years. Your trust and your pour over will, or if you just have a will, sit down and read it together, you and your spouse. I would say every 4 to 5 years, you're probably going to need to change something. You don't need to change it when another child is born. That's automatically taken care of in the trust or the will. Sometimes you'll change trustees. Sometimes you'll change guardians. Then you have to have a change. My guess, a change, a simple change like that would cost you $50 to $100. Sometimes it gets to the point where you have so many changes, you need to redo the whole thing. Now you're into a whole deal. Yeah. Right back here. A military background, usually the military provides that for you. Yeah, if your husband is going into the military, if he's serving, they usually will sit down and provide that service for you. If not, call our office and we'll see that you get help. A holographic will is a handwritten will. It does have some authority, but it's easy to make mistakes on that thing. You got to make sure it's witnessed. You got to make sure it says it right. You got to make sure after you're gone that everybody understands what you wanted to do and when you wanted to do it. If you write a holographic will in your jargon, using your thought process, when you're gone, people may not have a clue to understand what you're trying to say. That's why you need someone to help you to make sure it's not pierceable by someone challenging it. I'm not for holographic wills. I think that's dangerous because of someone contesting it. You know, folks, you've spent your life accumulating an estate. You want to be a steward of that estate. You want to pass it on to your heirs or the Lord's work or both. You don't want to blow that. You don't want to make a mistake there and see all those things eaten up by attorney's fees and court costs. And you want to make sure it's done right. And once it's done right, then all you got to do is monitor it. Read it every once in a while to see if it does what you want to do. You know what? You're buying an insurance policy when you use an attorney. If a change to estate planning laws comes down the pike and you've hired an attorney, he has an obligation to call you and say to you, you know what? There were some recent changes in California law. We need to amend your estate planning because now it doesn't adhere to state law. You're not going to know when those changes occur. You'll have no clue to that. So when you pay an attorney, in a sense, you're buying an insurance.